Welcome to the deep dive. Looking for that shortcut to being the most informed person in the room? Well, you found it. Today, we're diving into the life of Camille Pissarro, his paintings, gentle, light-filled landscapes, his actual life. Surprisingly radical. Yeah, he's often called the father of Impressionism. And, you know, our sources really back that up. He wasn't just painting. He was the organizational force, the glue holding this pretty volatile group together. Pissarro was like the ultimate survivor in an art world that seemed determined to push him out.
Right. And our mission today really is to unpack how his unique background, I mean, born in the Caribbean, his strong anarchist beliefs, how all that didn't just seep into his art, but actually shaped his crucial role as, well, the mentor and guide for the whole Impressionist movement. We're digging into the man, not just the film's pictures.
Okay, let's unpack this, because Pissarro's start is completely different from what you might expect for a French master. He was born Jacob Abraham Camille Pissarro in 1830, but not in France.
No, not Paris. St. Thomas, which was Danish West Indies then, now it's part of the U.S. Virgin Islands.
And the crucial thing here, right from the beginning, is his outsider status. He grew up in a Jewish family, but they were kind of marginalized locally. Why was that?
Well, his father married his deceased uncle's widow, his aunt, and that was forbidden by the local Sephardic Jewish congregation's rules at the time.
So that meant consequences for the kids.
Yeah, it did. Pissarro and his siblings couldn't attend the official Jewish school. Instead, they went to an all-black primary school.
Mm-hmm.
So that outsider perspective, that empathy maybe, it starts really early.
Then he gets sent off to boarding school in France when he's 12. Comes back to St. Thomas and gets stuck working as a clerk in the family business for 5 years.
5 long years, just drawing in his spare time, apparently. You can imagine him itching to do something else.
Until he's 21, and this Danish artist, Fritz Melby, shows up.
Exactly. Melby basically says, look, you should be a professional artist. And Pissarro just goes for it. He leaves the family business, packs up, and spends 2 years as an artist in Venezuela with Melby.
Wow, quite a leap. Then he finally lands in Paris in 1855. So what kind of training does he get there? Who's influencing him?
Well, initially, he's looking at the realists, Courbet, Millet, those guys. But the big influence, the one who really sort of mentored him informally, was Camille Corot.
Corot, landscape painter. And he got Pissarro into painting outdoors en plein air.
Yes, Corot was a huge advocate for working outside to capture the light and feel of a place.
But Pissarro took it a step further, didn't he, than Corot, I mean.
He absolutely did. See, Corot would sketch outdoors, capture the essence, but then he'd finish the painting back in the studio. Pissarro started finishing his canvases entirely outdoors, often in one go.
Which gives them that immediacy, that rawness.
Exactly, that sense of being right there.
Right.
But the official Paris Salon, they hated it. They called his work vulgar. Too real, not idealized enough.
Right. And the big rejection moment was 1863, the Salon des Refusés, the exhibition of rejected works. He was in there with Cézanne, and even there they got hostile reviews.
Yeah, but even in his early stuff, like Two Women Chatting by the Sea, St. Thomas from 1856, you see that commitment. He's painting ordinary working people, in this case Afro-Caribbean women, with real dignity. That thread runs through his whole career.
Okay, so he's facing rejection. What happens next? This is where his role changes, right?
What's fascinating here is, yeah, Pissarro's role shifts. It becomes organizational, almost spiritual for the group. After just years and years of the Salon saying no, Pissarro basically says enough.
He proposes they do it themselves.
Exactly. He goes to his friends Monet, Cézanne, Renoir, Degas, and says, look, let's just set up our own show. Stop begging for approval.
And that leads to the Société Anonyme des Artistes, Peintres, Sculpteurs et Graveurs in 1873, the Anonymous Society. Why anonymous? That sounds intentional.
It was deeply intentional.
Yeah.
Very political. By calling themselves anonymous, they were thumbing their noses at the whole state-run system. The Salon, the critics, the academy. It was a declaration of independence.
And Pissarro wrote the charter. He was the driving force behind actually making it happen.
Yeah. He was the key. He drafted the initial rules. He was the one pushing, organizing, making sure it actually materialized into that first Impressionist exhibition in 1874. He wasn't just painting alongside them. He was building the platform.
So that's why they called him Father Pissarro. It wasn't just age, though. He did go gray early.
No, it was that role. He was the calm center, the wise, gentle figure holding together this, frankly, difficult group of personalities. You had Pissarro, the anarchist.
And Degas, the anti-Semite. Monet, the atheist Republican. How did Pissarro, being Jewish and an anarchist, navigate that?
It seems his genuine sincerity, his quiet dignity, and his absolute commitment to the idea of the group allowed him to bridge those divides. Everyone seemed to trust him, even if they disagreed fundamentally on other things. He believed in the collective effort.
And the proof is in the pudding, right? The fact that he was the only one.
The only one. To exhibit in all 8 Impressionist exhibitions over 12 years. Others dropped out, came back, argued. Pizarro was just there every single time. The bedrock.
Incredible consistency. And he wasn't just supporting his peers, he was looking ahead too, mentoring younger artists.
Definitely. He was incredibly supportive. Cézanne famously called him a father for me. He also guided Gauguin for a while, even gave some pointers to Vincent van Gogh briefly. He was that bridge figure connecting Impressionism to what came next, post-Impressionism.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Because that generosity, that mentorship, it wasn't just him being a nice guy. It was tied into his politics, wasn't it? His focus on rural life, on peasants.
Absolutely. It was deeply connected to his radical anarchist beliefs. In the 1880s, this becomes even more explicit in his work.
He starts painting peasants at work, ordinary people, but giving them this monumental quality, like a young peasant having her coffee from 1881.
Precisely. He's elevating the common laborer, giving them the heroic status usually reserved for, you know, gods or kings in traditional art. This was visual egalitarianism.
And he was actively involved in anarchist circles.
Oh, yes. He subscribed to radical journals like Le Revolte. He corresponded with leading anarchist thinkers. For Pizarro, individual freedom, mutual aid, rejection of capitalism's inequalities, these weren't abstract ideas. They were principles to live by and to express through his art. Painting a peasant wasn't just scenery. It was a statement about dignity and labor.
But then, even with these strong convictions and his established style, he throws a curveball. 1885, he meets Seurat and Signac.
And he does something pretty shocking for an artist of his stature and age. He adopts their technique, pointillism or divisionism, this very meticulous scientific approach to color.
He just dives in after being the father of Impressionism.
Completely. Reinvented his whole process. And, you know, some critics who'd previously mocked the Impressionists were actually kind of impressed by this. They noted he was the only one who really crossed that bridge from Impressionism into Post-Impressionism so deliberately. It showed he was still searching, still experimenting.
But he didn't stick with it long term, did he?
No, only for about 4 years. He eventually found pointillism too rigid, too systematic. It didn't suit his more spontaneous temperament, his desire to capture fleeting effects quickly.
So he goes back to his Impressionist roots.
He does, but the experiment wasn't wasted. His later Impressionist work, like Woman with a Green Headscarf from 1893, it feels maybe firmer. The colors are incredibly subtle, maybe informed by that deep dives into color theory. So he returned, but enriched.
We should also touch on the hardships, though. It wasn't an easy path financially or personally. He was disinherited, right? Struggled with poverty for ages.
For most of his life, yes. And then the Franco-Prussian War in 1870-71 brought just devastating loss. His house outside Paris was occupied by soldiers.
And his paintings.
An estimated 1,500 early works were destroyed, just gone. There are stories, maybe apocryphal, maybe not, that soldiers literally used canvases as, like, doormats or to cover muddy patches in the garden.
1,500 paintings, that's staggering. The loss of potentially formative work.
It's a huge tragedy. And some art historians argue that this loss might be why we often think of Monet first when we think of the start of Impressionism. Pizarro's earliest experiments might have been lost, erasing evidence that maybe he was the true pioneer. We just don't know for sure what was lost.
And then, later in life, another blow. A physical one.
Yeah, in his later years, he developed a chronic recurring eye infection. It made painting outdoors, his whole thing, incredibly painful, even dangerous for his sight.
So what does he do? He can't work on plein air anymore.
He adapts. Again, it's incredible. This necessity forces him indoors, and it leads to this whole amazing late life series of cityscapes.
Painted from windows.
Exactly. From hotel rooms, rented apartments in Paris, Rouen, London. He'd get a room with a view and just paint what he saw.
So works like the Boulevard Montmartre at night with those new electric lights or Rue Saint-Honoré in the rain, those came about because he physically couldn't be outside.
That's right. The limitation sparked a whole new direction.
Okay.
And these window views, they still capture the dynamism, the atmosphere, the fleeting light of modern life, just from a fixed perspective. Hmm. He kept working, kept innovating, right up until his death in 1903.
Wow. What a life.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, his legacy really boils down to consistency and integrity, doesn't it? The only one in all 8 shows. Adapting constantly, stylistically, physically, and holding on to his social vision through it all, He only really found financial security near the very end of his life.
And now his works sell for millions.
Exactly. It's quite the arc.
So, summing up Pizarro's journey from St. Thomas, this outsider, to becoming the quiet anchor of the Parisian avant-garde, it's clear his art and his political drive were just completely intertwined.
He really was the foundation stone for Impressionism. The conscience, the mentor, the quiet force that kept that brilliant, chaotic group together long enough to literally change art history.
Okay, so here's a final thought for you, the listener, to chew on. Think about Impressionism. We usually picture, you know, sunny picnics, boat parties, leisure time. But the guy holding it all together, the father's figure, was actually a committed anarchist who saw his art as a way to champion the common worker and express egalitarian ideals. How does knowing that change the way you look at one of his seemingly gentle landscapes? That's your deep dive for today.